Okay.
As I indicated to some people who asked about it a little bit ago, people are concerned about what the presentations that are upcoming a week from Thursday are. And I'm intending them to be preliminary, so that they would include people getting up and saying, here's the project I'd like to do. I've done a little bit of it. Here's a figure. But I'm intending to do this and this and this. There's enough time for approximately 15-minute or slightly plus presentations. So if you can think about doing a 15-minute presentation a week from Thursday, but not on a completed project, but possibly even saying, I'd like to do this, is that the right thing to do? And the class can then discuss with you. One person will present the next session after, because they won't be available for that session. So that's what the presentations are supposed to be, not completed finished projects. And hopefully the discussion about what to do and whether that, you know, will be useful to us. The two things I wanted to cover today are, I first wanted us to discuss among ourselves, you know, not just me, but all of you, and I mean all of you, how you analyze things at different levels of, within levels ranging from individual growth up to between species, what kinds of analysis one can do and what kinds of information you could get out, and what statistical tools would be appropriate. I'd like to spend as much as, well, at least half our session today on that. Now I'm going to go over a bunch of levels and then open it to you. And I don't want just one or two people to do all the talking. I will do brutal things to try to ensure that. And then I'm going to go on to starting to talk a bit more about optimum selection and Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes, which is it's important at the phylogeny level, not necessarily, well, not as much for the other levels. But we'll get to that, but I wanted to do this discussion-y thing, and we can work on the, we can scribble on the blackboard, the whiteboard over there, while we do it. So I guess I wanted to start out with, okay, let's start out with within individuals. So suppose you have data, you've now heard about things like Procrustes superposition and Procrustes distances and things like that. You've also heard from Fred the things about partial warps and a kind of principal componency machinery that you can do for morphometric data. Okay, so this one's actually a little difficult. If you're looking at single growth of individuals, and that's the level that you're looking at, then you're looking at different time points in the development of individuals. And it strikes me that there are two kinds of data. Let me see. The one would be where you have a sequence of observations on a single individual. So you take many individuals, but for each one you digitize the form at 2 days of age, you digitize the form at 10 days of age, you digitize the form. You keep digitizing the same individual throughout its growth. Okay. That's one case. Another case that you'd have to deal with if you were interested in this kind of data is, what happens if the testing is destructive? What happens if you can digitize the fish, but the fish dies in the process? Okay. So now what you have is a bunch of fish, and they're growing. They're all, let's say they're all the same age, and you digitize some of them at 2 days, and some of them at 10 days, and some of them at 15 days, and so on. So you have a time sequence, but it's not within a single individual, but it's still trying to get at the same thing, what the course of growth is, and how the different landmarks are, how the size is changing and the shape is changing. So where does the machinery that Fred was talking about fit into this? What would you advise a person who was interested in this to do? There is, by the way, when you have a sequence of observations of single individuals, you have available to you a kind of information that's not available the other way, and that is, if an individual is large at 2 days, is it one of the larger individuals at 10 days? That you can get from this kind of information. I think it's inherently unavailable if you do that, because you lost. I mean, except it is possibly available for quantitative genetic breeding design, the genetic correlations from age to age, but not. The full information is not. Anyway, what would you, now this will be for you to tell me, what would you tell a person to do if they're trying to follow form and shape, form being shape plus size, what would you tell them to do? They've taken these fish and they've digitized them, let's say 2D, but 3D is possible too. And now they have those digitized fishes. Let's say in simple case here. How do you start out?
So you want to rotate so all the landmarks are as close as possible to each other from sets, from measurement to measurement. Like very usual screening. All of the samples you have are comparable. And then, do you want to scale them or not? Because if you're looking at form, then scaling is appropriate. But if you're looking at shape, it's not. Is that correct?
Well, certainly, that's a big issue. And the first issue you raised is, you know, that's a good issue to raise, because a naive thing to do, it seemed to me. What's the naive thing to do that doesn't take that first thing into account?
You just take a single point, set that as your middle, like, or set some median point, and then just base all of your.
Well, you can, in the Procrustes superposition. It automatically, you can show out algebraically, will center the individuals on their centroid. So if this is a form, here are the landmarks. Okay, there's an average of those points maybe here. Okay, that's the centroid. If I have two forms, and they're a little bit different. What it will automatically do, when you say, well, I want to take the sums of squares of distances between corresponding points, and I want to make that as small as possible. That's what a Procrustes superposition of two forms is doing. It will automatically superpose the centroids. They sit right on top of each other. Now, that may not be the best, you know, there may be something to be said for other superpositions, but anyway, that's what they do. And then they rotate them so as to reduce the sums of squares. There's actually a formula for that, so you can do the rotation in one operation. It's a moment calculation, and you do it on each of them, and you rotate to get them the same. And then there is the issue of scaling, of making them bigger and smaller, which you may or may not want to do. If you do the full Procrustes superposition, you're rescaling each, and you're rescaling it so the sums of squares from the centroid out to everybody. If you take the square root of that, it's a measure of size. It's one possible measure of size. And you the crusty superposition will actually adjust those, scale those, so that they are the same. And that's not magical. That is not necessarily the best measure of size, but it's what Procrustes does. I think you're barely able to restrain yourself.
Yeah. Is that a question? So for growth, you means you want to keep that scale, right? Like how you, what you scale it by. So that tells you the overall organism
is growing. It's getting bigger. Yeah.
But then if you have differences in growth between different landmarks, the shape analyses will capture that after you scale it. And then what do you do with the size? Do you maintain that scale and just, I don't know, do you bring it back in with for the form?
If you adjust their scales to fit, you've lost the size information unless you, if all that you then use is the resulting digitized coordinates, you've lost the size. You'd have to at least write something down. So
then you just completely lost it at that point. You have that. You scaled it, though. So
you did. I mean, you had information, and you wrote away. If all you did was to do a generalized Procrustes analysis where they minimize their least squares and they superimpose as well as they can, and that includes rescaling them, and you didn't bother to write down the numbers.
But you know how much you scale.
Yeah, you do. You can have your program save it. And of course, then you haven't lost. In principle, you still have all the information because, you know, you have it. So, but you raised, I forget, yeah, you raised the issue. Well, what if one of the points is changing, is sort of changing, moving much more than the others? And what if it were true that my thumbs, that as I would, here I'm an imaginary form, that as I'm growing, maybe my thumb is getting disproportionately longer. And that's here, allometry.
But does that require size information to you?
It does. Because let me just give you a little of the history, because that's worth knowing. Allometry has to do with the issue of whether the allo is different, so the root for difference, so it's where the measurement, the growth rate of one thing is growing disproportionately to others.
But wouldn't that, in effect, change the shape?
Yeah, it does.
So, but
it
still,
does.
You still need the size, though.
I don't know why you don't need the size. I'd keep the size around. Now, you can do Procrustes superpositions without changing size, but then really what it is this Boas coordinates, the Boas positions. And by the way, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they are the same in every respect except the rescaling. That is, the rotation isn't any different in the two. It's the same rotation, and the centering of the centroids are the same, or superposed in both cases. But then it's just a matter of whether you're rescaling. Let me just mention that Julian Huxley, who was a famous British biologist, English biologist of the early years of the 20th century, the first roughly half of the 20th century, was the grandson of the famous Huxley, who was Thomas Henry Huxley, who was Darwin's great friend and defender, Darwin's bulldog, as he was called. Julian, I was asked years ago to give a Huxley lecture at the Systematics Association in London, and I did. And I thought, this is an honor to be asked to give a talk at a series of talks named after Thomas Henry Huxley. And then I looked it up and discovered it was named after Julian Huxley. And I thought, he's the lesser Huxley. And then I looked up his achievements, and I wasn't so sure he was the lesser Huxley. I mean, he, by the way, is the guy who coined the name ethnic group. If you've ever heard the word ethnic group, he invented it. He also coined the name Klein. That's his word. He was very interested in quantitative aspects of evolution. His most famous achievement is probably in 1944, I think it was, when he published a book called Evolution, the Modern Synthesis, which is one of the great, it was one of the great expositions, along with works by Dobzhansky, Simpson, Meyer, and Ledyard Stebbins, of, it was one of the five great explanations of the modern synthesis, and the word synthesis comes from his book title. And it was a very good book. But the other thing he did is invented not only the word allometry, but some of the concepts. And he basically said, suppose we have size changing, and let's call that X, and we have another measurement, Y. Well, of course, if they're changing in proportion, there's some constant of proportionality, A. But then he said, well, if they're changing, suppose that one is growing at a different rate than the other. In that case, the sort of natural relationship with them would be a power relation, that X, sorry, I've got it backwards. That's not a good explanation. Y, the other trait, as a function of X, which is a size, will go like this. That is, it'll be X raised to a power times a multiplier is Y. You can take logarithms and you can say log Y is equal to log of A plus B log of X. So then the thing is to say, if you measure, you know, my height and the length of my thumb, and I grow, and my thumb is getting disproportionately longer, or is growing a little bit slower, that will be reflected by the fact that when we regress, my thumb's log of my thumb's length on log of my size, there will be a constant here, but the growth rate B will tell us whether that's growing allometrically. B unequal to 1 is allometry. B of 1 is just saying the one is growing proportionate to the other. Now, the issue comes up. One of the things you might want to ask about is how do you do that in a morphometric context? And the answer is going to be frustrating. It's not going to be so easy to do. One thing you could do is superpose all of your specimens. Suppose you have 10 different ages. Take those 10 digitized individuals and just put them all in a general Procrustes analysis and get them all superposed. You could rescale them and keep track of their sizes, or you could do a Boas fit of them and measure size somehow. But a really important question is, what do you want to do if you have one point that's moving much more than the others? How do you want to define size? I mean, the classic example, the example in morphometrics is what's called Pinocchio effect. Here's, you know, I hope you'll all be familiar with the Italian literary character Pinocchio in children's stories, and he has a form with a nose. And Pinocchio, as he tells lies, his nose gets much longer. So one of the questions that comes up in a superposition, I showed you figures on this before, don't have one right hand, is that when you superpose Pinocchio, the sensible superposition would be to superpose the forms, this might be out here, letting the nose change a lot, and the other in return for which, if you do pre-telling, before telling a lie, and after telling a lie, and the nose has gotten longer, this is a much more informative picture. But what will a Procrustes superposition do? It'll try to reduce that. And in process, it'll take all these purple circles and move them back a little bit. So it will be telling you that the back of Pinocchio's head moved backward. and the nose didn't quite grow as much. And so people worry about this. Can we somehow have an analysis that lets us focus on the nose when it is in fact the nose that's wrong? So the issue is, if you go through time and you have like fishes and one point on the fish is moving much more than the others, the question I'll raise is, should one maybe have a way of excluding that point from the analysis when you're trying to figure out what size is? Of using only the other points as size. So, and I don't have a simple, at this point I don't have a simple methodology for you. The Procrustes thing will succumb to a Pinocchio effect. It'll make it look a little bit as if all the other points moved. It'll make it look a little bit as if the nose didn't grow as much and the other points moved away in the opposite direction. So it'll basically give you a size measure that's partly the length of the nose. I think this is an important thing to scratch your head about, to worry about. But the other issue that I think is pretty serious is, okay, here's the classic Julian Huxley type equations over here, and you've got a thing called size that is somehow, and usually people do that by making it like snout vent length or something, or total height. They'll use some convenient measurement for size. But that's not thinking morphometrically. What do we do when we've got Procrustes superpositions? And I think there's a problem here. Do people see the problem? What's one thing one could take as size? We're getting all the answers from the same two people.
In Procrustes' analysis, in effect, is sort of taking the area as the size, right?
It's not quite the area. It's the sum of squares. The root mean square of the distances out from the centroid. That's not quite the same as area. You could take area. You could take area, although some digitized analyses will give you an outline plus the location of the eye. In which case, the location of the eye doesn't affect. This thing you're calling area would only reflect the other. Whereas if you were doing a centroid, root mean square out to the centroid, the position of the eye would come into. So anyway, you could use the Procrustes, the centroid, I think it's called centroid size, I'm trying to remember what it's called. Fred has used the right phrase. You could take a centroid size. Now, in a Pinocchio, if there's a Pinocchio effect, that's allowing the length of the nose to partly determine the size. Now when you go to try to apply the Julian Huxley thing, you have to say, okay, the size has an advantage, the centroid size has an advantage, it's a positive number, it can never go negative, it's a sum of squares and then square root. And you can work with the log of that, that's fine, but if you're now saying, okay, I want to know if the nose is growing allometrically. I want to know, if you get to these different sizes, is the nose moving too much? Well, what is the Y measurement you're making? Where do you measure from to get to the nose?
If the nose grows straight out from the centroid of the
Earth, there's no. You think there's a biological law that says it grows, everything knows where the centroid is?
Right. So there isn't. Knows it starts here.
Yeah, it's even possible if you were measuring, let's say, from the centroid. Let's take the centroid to be about here. If you were measuring from that centroid, you could, in principle, get a form where the nose went backwards and got indented and went on the other side of the centroid. And then you would have a negative value of the distance from the, you know, you'd have a negative value of the displacement from the centroid. And if you allowed that to be negative, you can't take the logarithm. So I think actually it is not simple to figure out how to use the Huxley-type equation, as sophisticated as it, you know, it's about a 1935, 31 to 35 formula, but it assumed you had a sort of length of something, or area of something. Whereas when you have digitized landmarks, it's not obvious that, you know, first of all, there's the issue, well, what do you mean by size? Do you want to include the nose? Or do we want to somehow figure out how the nose moved from a size based on everybody else? You know, and I'm just going to leave those questions up in the air. I'm not going to solve them for you. I don't entirely know. If you had a parametric model, if you had a formula that you thought told you how growth proceeded and had some parameter for how the nose moves, you can then think about doing maximum likelihood or Bayesian or some kind of statistical analysis that would estimate those parameters. In the absence of a parametric model, you're kind of groping around. You're kind of saying, we're not completely sure of the processes involved. What's a good measure of size? So I'll just leave it there. I mean, I'm not going to... And then there is the interesting issue that you raised, no, Cooper, you raised, which was, how about in the superposition, not doing an overall superposition, but somehow superposing adjacent forms that are adjacent in time? And like, for example, it would be a very naive way of doing that would be that you did the sum of square. Let's say you had time points T1, T2, T3, and T4. Now you're going to do a Verkhovskis type superposition. And what you're going to do is take the sum of squares of differences between these two forms. You mentioned that. Also between those two. But not further. The generalized Verkhovskis analysis does all pairs. So it worries about superposing T1 and T4 over each other. Now this would be a different superposition. But it seems kind of natural. And it basically says if there is a correlation between shapes here and here and here and here and here and here, which there, we kind of feel there ought to be, then maybe the superpositions that really matter are these successive superpositions. And maybe, therefore, you should have not the generalized Verkhovskis analysis, but this kind of, I don't know what name it has, sequential Verkhovskis. And you could do it. It can be done. So, again, if you had a parametric model of how the thing was growing and were estimating parameters in that, this would all fall out naturally. That is, something like it would turn out to be occurring and would be implied by your full analysis.
Could you also do sort of a censored Verkhovskis thing in terms of Pinocchio and try to do a Verkhovskis where you leave out the nose and then look and compare, because that would give you some measure, right? Like if
it's incredibly relevant. Okay. And just mechanically doing Verkhovskis of all pairs and all landmarks, you know, it'll give you, it's probably pretty good, but it's not the whole story by any means, and it's not necessarily the best one. Yeah.
So I'm just going to regurgitate what That's wonderful. Like, you know, because I have mosquitoes with different atrocity size lengths. And so you mentioned using the median instead of the mean.
Yeah, it's a technique. I mean, I was going to say I invented it, but I didn't invent it really. That there is in fitting high dimensional data, particularly things like gene expression levels, thousands of gene expression levels, and inferring covariances among them, people have spent a lot of time trying to figure out what small value, how to drop small values and only see the large values. And there's a lot of work out there and statistics on and the L1 norm. And the L1 norm is the, not the, let's, let me get this straight. The centroid size is a root mean square, which is a size which is the sum of the differences between the points squared. A sensible way is to divide that by the number of points and then square root it. The division by the number of points is not important here because it just throws in a constant. But people have said, well, you know, what about taking, instead of the square, what about just taking the first power to the 1, which really doesn't change anything. It's just the sum of absolute values and not square rooting them. You don't didn't square, so you don't have to undo it. And that, it turns out that if you're doing that, I have to be really careful here. If you just have values on one scale, if you had one-dimensional values, the point that minimizes that, the point that minimizes this, is the mean, the ordinary mean. Okay, that's the centroid in one dimension. The point that minimizes these is the median, which, by the way, with 4 points is not uniquely defined. It could be anywhere between here and there. But if you had 5 points, it would be that. Okay. And if you do that, if you have a case like this, where one point is going crazy and the others are hardly moving, it will superpose, by superposing medians, it will superpose everything else and then show uniquely that one point moving. It's a convenient technique. The only catch is if the number of Pinocchio points gets big, you know, then it's not so good. If the number of Pinocchio points is a small fraction of them, this is great.
The case of fraction is very good, then it's better to what Andy said, rather to do the progressives without.
It might be, I'm not sure. If you had, again, if you have a parametric model of what's going on, it's best to fit things in the model and to do your superposition as part of that model fitting. But yeah, I mean, so you were raising the fact of you could use medians instead of means, and I have found in when I do what I've done is I'll show you some at some point, and I have showed you a little earlier. You can, with phylogeny analyses, you can end up getting a principal component showing you the direction in which the forms are changing the most, and looking at the coefficients of that principal component. If you do a median, if you subtract away their median, you will see very clearly if some of them are moving a large amount and the others are almost not moving. I found that it works pretty well. These median, use of medians for things like this is very big right now. L1 norms, which is just another way of saying the absolute value differences, which lead to medians, is very big right now in things like, you know, high-dimensional data analysis where where you have a big covariance matrix of things and you really don't really think that most of those covariances are real, just the big ones. then this is a way of, one of the ways of reducing things. Okay, that's growth. What about multiple individuals in a population? Suppose I have a population of individuals. Now, we're not concerned with growth, where they're all grown up. But we have population-level variation, and we want to look at that. What do we do about things like crusties? Size is still important. They can differ in size. You're measuring phenotypic variation, only you're doing it at multiple points. And you want to know things like in which directions is the change biggest. And you can do things like principal components. There is the same issue with respect to Pinocchio, that if one point is varying a lot more than others, do you want to do the superposition as an overall for crusties, or do you want to do something more robust? But one thing you can think about doing, depending on how tractable your organism is, you're not going to do this for redwood trees or great whale or blue whales, okay? But you could do it with mice. And people have. You could think of looking at the quantitative genetics of it and getting variance components and asking not only about phenotypic variation, but asking in which directions is the genetic variation as opposed to the environmental variation. In particular, which direction is the additive genetic variation? And the way you do that is by doing breeding designs. So you have collections of half-sibs, or you have parent-offspring pairs. And there's a whole standard set of breeding designs, and there are ways of doing maximum likelihood or Bayesian analyses of more unconventional breeding designs, including pedigrees. So you go out, let's say you're collecting these individuals from the wild, but you've somehow kept track. You've been marking, you've been banding the birds, and you've kept track of who is the offspring of who. I have to say, collecting pedigrees from the wild has a major problem, which is environmental effects, that it could be that the birds living in the north end of the woods have a different environment than the birds living in the south end of the woods. And in the models that you're likely to be fitting here, you may not be taking that into account. You might not understand that in the lab, when you do breeding in the lab and you force them into a pedigree, you can also do things like randomize the... I did a quantitative genetics experiment crossing strains of mice, and we did randomize the placement of mouse cages in the mouse room so as to remove, at least a hope to randomize away some of the environmental effects. Maybe one end of the mouse room is colder than the other, and they're not growing quite as well there. But you can think about, breeding designs where you do the breeding. You think about collecting pedigrees of individuals if they're doing this in the wild. So those are the concerns there. I guess I could ask you questions about how to do the crusty stuff, but it's the same issues. It's the same issues of how do you handle Pinocchio-like effects? How do you summarize them? There's that. Now, here's one that actually has not been worked on enough. What do you do if you have, instead of one population of organisms, now you're going out and you're collecting individuals from different populations? Either ones that were reared in the wild, or possibly bringing, doing the Claus and Keck and Heise classic experiment where they bring individuals from different populations into a common garden,
the common garden experiments. Do you all know about Claus and Keck and Isaac Pugh? Let me just explain. There were three, Jens Clausen, I forget who Keck is, what Keck's name was, but and William Heise, worked at the Carnegie Institute in Stanford, near Stanford University in the 1940s and 50s. And they did a classic experiment where they took Achillea, which is a yarrow, Queen Anne's lace, and they got individuals from the peak, from high in the Sierra, populations high in the Sierra, down the slopes of the Sierra in California, the valley below. So they had a sort of geographic transect, and they had a bunch of populations, and they differed greatly in altitude. And these plants, of course, in nature were very different sizes. They brought them into the common, they brought seeds into the common garden and planted them, and found that the high altitude, short, stunted, high altitude plants, when grown in a common garden, were shorter. That is, if part of that shortness was genetic and not, it was a classic experiment. By the way, one of their research assistants on this was Arthur Fruckeberg, who was then moved up to the University of Washington, and he was the guy giving the evolution course when I got here. Almost 50 years ago. Art was very nice. He just died. He was a great guy, a very welcoming and a positive person. But he had been their research assistant in this classic set of experiments. So suppose you look at multiple populations and you want to know how form and shape change or vary among those populations. What are the issues that will come up there? Some of them are the same issues.
I think there could be some missing values if we compare most of human, maybe some landmark species in the mass, but not in the human.
Well, okay, that's fair. Although here they're not different species, they're different. They're the same species, but multiple populations. So we're not quite there. I would think in the case where you're comparing different species that you just can't find the landmark in one of the species. Not that there are cases where the digitization process failed and you never found out where the eye was, okay, or something like that. That's one way that I'm missing you. The other is that you're raising the issue, maybe conceptually we can't find it. Like, You're digitizing the tails of mammals, and you come to humans who don't have a tail, and you can't. There are some bones you could digitize, but you might also say, well, I can't collect to a length of tail in a great ape, let's say, because it doesn't have a tail. I think the correct thing to do there is just use the ones that are in common, and not. But In a phylogenetic analysis, you might have many of them that had tails and then some of them that don't, and yes, that's a problem. Because you might want to know about tail growth phylogenetically among all the animals that do have tails, but know about everything else on the whole set. But let's go back to single species and multiple population. What issues are there? Yes, that's a problem. And that's a problem we know with other kinds of measurements. If you were taking a physiological measurement, a concentration of red blood cells in the blood, which is not a morphometric, not in any way a morphometric thing, that would also be a problem. If you're fitting statistical models that are kind of assuming that the within-population variation is the same in each population within it, but the means might differ, and that's not true, then yes. I mean, then one thing, for physiological measurements, one of the things you do is, let's look for a transform. Maybe if we put them on the log scale or the square root scale, variability will be about the same in the different populations. I don't know how to do that with morphometrics. I'm not sure
How to go, you know, if somebody comes along and said, take the logs of these, I'd say, wait a second, they're around the center, and some of them are positive, and some of them are negative. We can't take the logs of the negative one. Then they might say, well, move the centroid over here, you know, measure everybody from over here so they're all positive, and then I'd say, but this point is arbitrary. You know, that's not a biologically meaningful point. So for issues like transforming scales, I'm not sure I know how to do it for orthometrics.
So I'm curious with multiple populations, if you're running a PCA or a PCO.
I'm familiar with what a PCO is, principal components analysis, and I don't know what a PCO is.
Principal
coordinates.
Oh, I'm familiar with principal coordinates, but I don't call it PCO. That's, you know, okay, yeah. Let's call it PCO. That's fine.
Whatever you call it. Anyway, do you run it on all of the individuals that you did, or do you run it on the individual populations? If you run it on all of the individuals, then you at least have the same coordinate system across all of them, right? And then maybe you can eliminate individuals to look at groupings so that you can see the populations.
But then, yeah,
but
I
then
mean
you're also, you do both.
It's one of these things to agonize about. It's
hierarchical.
It's kind of a similar question to what you asked here. That is, do we do an overall Procrustes, or do we do a Procrustes that's somehow structured in a way that corresponds to our to what might have happened?
Ideally, you do it forecasting forth and then comparing it by this overall, and then if you just do it overall, and it's still.
So wait, you're doing what, and then what?
Well, if you do the analyses on the whole group without grouping them up, and that breaks it up, that nicely breaks them up, groups that would, say, be over.
Well, wait, there's two issues here. One is this issue of how do you take into account what you know about which population they came from. There's a secondary issue, which I didn't put up here, but I should have probably. What if you don't know what population they came from and you want to allocate them? I think you sort of brought that up. I thought I heard you do that. Did you, or were you not thinking about that?
I kind of was, but I was thinking.
Yeah, because you were talking about doing an overall Procrustes superposition. Let's leave aside all these Pinocchio issues. And then naturally break them up into groups, whereas I was saying you somehow know which ones are in the north population, which ones in the central population, which ones in the south population.
So you would do both and kind of compare the results of both.
Well, I think there's a very real... I'm going to cop out. I'm going to say... If you had four populations and they were lined up like this, is the overall Procrustes the way to superpose them, or somehow something that takes into account which population they're in? Do you want to do a Procrustes within each population, superpose them relative to each other, and then rotate those against each other without reconsidering the within population? And I again say that if you have in a populations analysis some kind of an overall model and can fit parameters and can do the Procrustes-like superposition as part of that, that is optimal. That is more optimal. It's better. Short of that, I'd have to say, yeah, those are issues. And I don't know entirely. I mean, a good, quick, rough one would do overall Procrustes superposition and then start looking at the differences among groups. And then you can do things like, do people know about canonical variance analysis? Have people heard of discriminant analysis? In discriminant analysis, you have two groups, and you have, let's say you have variation between them, and you have some axes.
that are coordinates of some variable. Here we're not being morphometric, we're just considering any statistical variables. And then you say, what is the best axis for discriminating between those two groups? Okay, what that is what axis gives you the greatest difference between groups standardized by the difference within groups? In other words, maximizes the between group the between group difference as a fraction of the within group standard deviation of that axis. That is discriminant analysis. And that's done with two groups. Then there is another kind of multivariate analysis that's a very close cousin of that, and that says, suppose I've got a whole bunch of groups. So I have like eight groups. How many do I have there? 1, 2, 3, 4. 6. And there, one possible thing you could do is to, it's only one, is to say, let us find an axis that maximizes the between group variance of their means as a fraction of the within groups, the pooled within group, the within group standard deviation, where you in effect you take the groups and slide them all on top of each other and then consider it as one distribution and get its variances and covariances, and you're looking to find an axis that gets you the most spread between groups as a fraction of the variance as a ratio to the within group standard deviation, and that is canonical variance. And it is just a cousin of this, because for two groups, the two analysis, if you just have two groups, they're the same. They're the same analysis. So one of the things you could think of doing in multiple population, you have some kind of superposition, but the issue, as people have raised, the issue is not trivial. And you do... having done your superposition, you can then ask questions like, what are the axes for, if there are only two groups, for discriminant analysis or canonical variance? And canonical variance has multiple axes, because what you do is you take the biggest, the axis that shows the biggest spread, then you remove that and you go at right angles to it. If you're in a two-dimensional case, there's only one other axis, the axis that's right angles to it. But if you're in multiple dimensions, you take out the first one, and then the next biggest one is the second one, canonical variance, and the next biggest one is the third. All that can be done by very simple eigenvalue and eigenvector machinery. It's easy to do to get those axes by using eigenvector and eigenvalue routines in straightforward ways. All this was developed by multivariate statisticians in the middle of the 20th century. And it sort of follows on from principal components. Let me just mention while I'm at it one problem with principal components, and that is with principal components, if I have a length of character x and a length of character y. Now we're not talking morphometrics at the moment. And I have a scatter plot. We all know that the first principal component is the direction in which there is the most variation. Okay. Now suppose somebody comes along and says, let's measure this in millimeters, but this one in centimeters. Okay. What will that do? Well, it might squash this axis because the numbers in centimeters are much smaller. And then you might say, okay, we'll do principal PCA on that. Surely it won't matter whether we measure in centimeters or measure in millimeters for this, surely we'll get lines which, when we put them back on a common plot, will superpose right on top of each other. And the horrific fact is, they don't. If you have one that's in millimeters and one in centimeters, the one that's in millimeters will be paid more attention to because the numbers are bigger. And when you say, oh no, let's change our mind, let's go back to both having millimeters, the two principal components won't be right on top of each other. One will be tilted a little bit with the spectrum. So I think what you would get is the principal components. If it was in millimeters, the principal component would be tilted a little bit like that. So you got to worry. Whereas in canonical variates, you don't have that problem. If you were to change the scale of a variable, it turns out because you're standardizing by the within population variation, and that changes too, it turns out that this property of having the lines just sit on top of each other is maintained. It's okay in canonical variates and discriminant analysis. It's not okay in principal components. So let me finish up on this by. And by the way, I did have some more things here. I'm sorry. When you have multiple populations, you might have a situation where one population is very different, and it's kind of like a Pinocchio effect, in the sense that an analysis that looks at the variation among all the populations is not paying enough attention to that one population, and it will be overly influenced by the fact that the other populations aren't differing very much. So there's questions of who to compare with who. There also are serious issues of how do we test if we have environmental measures from these populations, like mean annual temperature. How do we test whether the differences are correlated with the environment? And when you do that, there's another problem which I don't think I wrote up here, which is adjacent populations exchange genes. And so if you're looking at, say, how they relate to an environmental variable, some of them might be residual, some of them might be a little bit off the let's say there's a regression line, some will be a little bit off the regression line. Our standard regression models assume that each point independently deviates from the regression line. When populations exchange members, okay, you know, each generation, so there's gene flow, then if one population's a little low, genetically a little low from below the regression line, its neighbors are also likely to be low because they share some of the same genetic adaptations. So the assumption of the regression that the points are independent is not true anymore. And I've been trying to raise this. I've written a couple of papers, but they're very obscure, and I haven't really made any good analytical tools available to people. I've been writing papers that are in like symposium volumes and other places where nobody looks. But I've been trying to raise this and trying to show that if we had a measure of gene flow among populations, if we had measures of gene flow between pairs of populations, there are in principle ways of trying to correct for this and do a more statistically valid fit, where if two populations that are right next to each other are both low or both high, you don't count those separately. You somehow take into account that those residuals are supposed to be correlated with each other. Some other people have also raised the same issue. So there are issues of gene flow causing non-independence of points in different populations. So the different populations may be in different environments and may have different mean annual temperatures, but they're not responding totally independently.
Couldn't that gene flow also cause a problem with a single population if the range were large enough, if you didn't
just...
Well, is it a population? I mean, if I spread them out,
I don't know,
far enough that they're not genetically all pandictic, if they're not pandictic...
If they are exchanging, but you just, by merit of the distance, you have less gene flow from the ends of the range, right?
Yeah. So I don't know if I want to call them a population. I mean, it's a legitimate issue. If you have some model in your head of how much gene flow there is, it doesn't matter whether you call them a population or not. This same issue comes up. If you were able to measure the gene flow and either had a parametric form for it or you measured it between all places, there are in principle ways of correcting for that. Not easy, but it's a serious issue. So I'll finish up by just mentioning that then you come to multiple species on a phylogeny, and that's where we've been talking about. We have been talking about how you correct for the phylogeny, that once again, when you're inferring things like a principal component of change, you want to take the phylogeny into account because the points are not independent. The same issue comes up with superposition. In order to get it, you might say, we start out with a progressive superposition, and then we go look at contrasts on the phylogeny. That's what I had you do in the exercise that you ran, where you all started by... I gave you Procrustes superposed forms. Later, we gave you a Procrustes routine to do them. Presumably, it would have yielded the same answers. And then I had you do contrasts on the phylogeny. But was that really the way to do it? Do we want to somehow have the superposition sensitive to where they are on the phylogeny, just as was true in this growth series, just as we might be true in a series of populations? Do we want to do some other kind of superposition that gives us a clearer picture of Pinocchio-like effects, where in this phylogeny the nose is changing a lot more than the rest of Pinocchio? What I want to do is just do about 10 minutes, get about 10 minutes into the other material. All of you participated in the discussion except for one of you. So she will... You good. Then you'll avoid me assigning you the role of asking a question at some other time. Please.
So if you have data for two of those bullet points, let's say I have morphological data for multiple populations and multiple species on the phylogeny, what is the better approach to evaluate both at the same time?
It would be wonderful if there were. Okay. It's a great task to... It's a great question to ask, and it's a great project to spend a good fraction of a lifetime on. But I wouldn't try to solve it between now and the end of this course. The thing is that, let me raise just one point to show you how sticky that one can be. I have a bunch of populations of humans, or let's say chimpanzees, and I have a bunch of population of gorillas. And there's maybe gene flow among the population. So these issues I was raising about how do you correct for the gene flow come up, okay, within each. Now think about it. They're on a phylogeny. Going back in time, there were populations there. Were they in the same place? Well, maybe you can assume that, or maybe not. And you might say, let's assume that the populations were always in the same place. Fine. Now we get back down here. What do we assume about the geographic structure of the ancestor? Well, unless they're sitting in exactly the same set of populations today, which chimps and gorillas aren't, you're not going to be able to assume that that population structure was always there and was always the same in both. So immediately, you're going to start scratching your head and saying, what do we do about that? maybe you can say we'd have the structure up here and we'll somehow solve the superposition problems and so on. And then we'll just ask about the species means evolving. That's probably a good approximation, but it's only an approximation. It isn't really grappling with the full structure. The same thing comes up, and I should say this, in phylogenies, this thing of are differences correlated with the environment. I was talking about populations where you could go and measure the present day temperatures. And then you could assume, you know, wave your hands and assume that the present day temperatures reflect what the differences in temperature were in the past. That's an assumption, but, you know, until recently it's not too bad an assumption. What about on a phylogeny? If you see individuals living at cold temperatures and individuals living at warm, species living at cold temperatures, another species living at warm temperatures, and you want to say, how did the phenotypes respond to those temperatures? That might require you to know what the temperatures were in those two lineages back into the past. Now, you can kind of look at the present-day temperatures and say, let's do a reconstruction. Let's make up a model for how temperatures change. Let's have the temperatures do Brownian motion. Well, that would enable you to ask this question, but it's a pretty arbitrary assumption. It's not too bad to assume genetic drift will cause populations to do Brownian motion. As we'll see now, but mostly next time, natural selection towards optima that themselves change may or may not be well modeled by Brownian motion. But how the mean temperature in the environment changed, it's not obvious. A meteorologist might not say Brownian motion, you're saying the temperatures wandered what? That's a more dubious one. So in raising the issue, you raised the issue of putting together the within species between population level with the species level. You know, come back in 50 years. You know, come back and some descendant of ours will be giving this talk and say, well, we now have the standard method. But I'm not 100% sure what that method would be, except that it will be a statistical approach of some sort. And if you throw in the environment question of how do you respond to the environment, you have to grapple with the issue of what are we going to assume about our knowledge of present-day environments tells us about the past. Maybe a geologist can give you some information. People can get, you know, marine environments and things. They can get oxygen 18 measurements and things like that. And you do want to integrate those if you in principle you can. But it would have to be a big conversation, not only between within species people and between species people, but with meteorologists and geologists as well. So, great question. Wonderful question. But too much of a question, you know. So these are all things to grapple with, and if anybody thinks, oh, there's no unsolved problems yet, boy, there are tons of unsolved problems here. So, okay. What I'm going to do, I just have about 5 minutes. I don't have any exercise or anything. I'm going to start in on... I'll just make sure I'm recording. I am. We were talking about the way a population... We're going back now to one variable. We're not making it even be necessarily morphometric. And I was talking to you about how quantitative genetics, a character controlled by quantitative genetics, and this slide I showed you before, you can show that the change in the mean of a population it wanders with genetic drift. The gene frequencies at the individual loci will wander. In a simple Fisherian model, that will roughly give you genetic drift. And the variance of the change will be the additive genetic variance divided by the population size or by the effective population size. Not twice the population size. It works out as that this is actually results equivalent to this were done by Sewell right in the 1930s. And I talked to you at that time about, well, suppose in addition to genetic drift, you've got mutation bringing in variation, and it's adding alleles that make the trait larger or smaller. What you can then show is that the amount of added genetic variation will change, in that genetic drift will reduce in every generation by multiplying by 1 minus 1 over 2n, where n is the, again, effective population size. So in a very, very large population where n is big, this number is small, the genetic variation reduces a little bit every generation. And mutational variation, if you make some assumptions about the way mutation comes in, you have to make some restrictive assumptions. The mutation is adding in variance, genetic variance, while the genetic drift is taking it away. You were about to...
You said 2n for effective population size, and n is half, and n is population size. Are we in a diploid?
We're diploid.
We're in a diploid.
We're normal. Okay. We are diploid, therefore that is normal.
Okay.
Yeah, this is for diploids. For a haploid, that 2 goes away. And I think it is possible for a haploid that this thing might get... No, that might be the same. I haven't thought about it. It's a little weird. Yeah, it would have to sit down and work it out again. Okay, so you can imagine a model where there's genetic drift, and the genetic variation is gradually going away, but it's being pumped up by mutation. And this is kind of Russ Landy universe, yeah?
And you would add also maybe down the road of variation.
If you do not have, let's say we take away the mutation, this is occurring in the context of random mating in a population with size n. So the mating part is in here. It's actually the mating part. If I have a population with certain added genetic variation, let's say it's a big population, and it undergoes a generation of random mating, the variance, the added genetic variance doesn't change.
No, I was talking like, is the environment effect is changing?
Well, are you thinking about natural selection or what?
Or even just,
I don't
know, genetic variation, or...
Well, there can be environmental effects that are direct effects on the character. Like, it gets cold and we all have trouble growing and we end up smaller, let's say. But I don't have that in this model. There would be, if the environment is changing and there are direct effects on the character, there'd be some variation of the mean due to that. There'd be another term there, due to the changes of environment. If the environment changing imposes natural selection, I'll ask you to wait because we're about to bring optimal selection in next time, really. So I'm just reminding you of this model. And it turns out that if you have a constant amount of mutational variation coming in, plus a fraction 1 over 2n going away, what it turns out is that the amount of genetic variation you end up with, you get... It starts declining, but it's being pushed up by mutation. It comes to an equilibrium. The equilibrium is here. It's 2n generations worth of mutational variation. It's saying if n is 1,000, it'll take you roughly 2,000 generations to lose your genetic variation. But meantime, 2,000 generations worth of mutation have come in. And it turns out that the equilibrium, you come to an equilibrium level and you wobble around that, and the equilibrium level is this. And then the very fascinating thing is, if you then say, okay, suppose that's the additive genetic variation, and we use the formula from the previous panel, then divide that by n, that's the change in the mean, and the variance of change in the mean, will be this, twice the mutational variance. So it says, in a big population, which is gradually losing added genetic variation, the additive genetic variance gets equilibrates at a large value in a small population, which is rapidly losing by genetic drift variation, and the same amount of mutation is coming in. It equilibrates at a lower level. The bigger population has more variance, the smaller population equilibrates at less. Then when you take into account how much drift does, there's more genetic variation in the big population, a fraction, one-nth of which tells you the mean. There'll be small changes of mean up there, and down below, there will be changes of mean which are a bigger fraction of the genetic variance, but there's less variance there. And it balances out. And it turns out that if you watch through time, the big population, the amount that the mean wanders by genetic drift will be the same as it, in principle, in the simple model, as it is in the small population. And that's very much a cousin of the result that Moto Kimura got for molecular sequence changes, which says that in neutral variation, the rate of protein substitution is the rate of substitution at any site is equal to the mutational rate. And it doesn't matter what size the population is, it cancels out, and it cancels out here too. So this is a quantitative genetics version of Kimura's principle for how much substitution you get. And where I'm headed is to go tell you a little bit more quantitatively with some more formulas. What happens when you have natural selection towards an intermediate optimum? This is a rehash of what I said before, but we're headed... Oh, yeah, and I was just going to say, I'll just say it before everybody escapes. You can do the same thing with multiple characters, and instead of a single scalar called the additive genetic variance, you have an additive genetic covariance matrix, and you get the same principle that the covariances of change in the means are equal to the mutational covariances. And then where we're headed next time is to start out with natural selection and to ask what the formulas are for natural selection. This is all for any kind of characters, including morphometric, but I'm glad we have the rest of the discussion today because I think it points out what some of the special problems are with using this morphometric machinery. So I better let you go, but I'll be here to answer any more questions.